something suspicious, if you see any signs of a search, please tell me. I will come at once. Should I send a fire message? Emma said, her happiness over the baby fading. Sometimes it is not possible to send a fire message. There are easier ways. He pressed something into her hand, a simple silver ring with a clear stone set into it. It's glass, he said. Smash the ring, and Tessa will know. She has the matching one. Emma slid the ring onto her finger. She thought of Kit standing faithfully beside Ty at the funeral. She thought of his pale curls and blue eyes and gamine face. Should she have guessed he had fairy blood somewhere? No. He didn't look like Mark. He looked like a Herondale. Like Jace. Like that was all he was. You can trust me, she said. I'll look out for Kit. Is there anything I can do about the ley lines? It would be useful to have a shadow hunter in Los Angeles, checking out the locus point of Malcolm's magic, said Jim. When you get home, contact Katerina Loss. She may want your help. I will, Emma said. It's good for me to have a purpose, I think. Libby's dead. Jason Clary are on a mission and can't be reached. And Horace Dearborn is the Inquisitor. It's like there's no hope for anything now. There is always hope, said Jim. When I was very young, it was still permitted to take spoils. The property of downworlders could be confiscated by any shadow hunter. I knew a man who kept the heads of slaughtered fairies in the institute he ran. Emma made a nauseated noise. There has ever been this strain of poison running through the dark heart of the glaive. But there are many more who know downworlders are our brothers. We are all children under the angel, he sighed. And though I cannot remain with you, simply smash this ring and I will come, no matter how distant I may be. He put an arm around her and hugged her close for a moment. Take care, Mamie. What does that mean? Emma asked. But he was already gone, vanishing into the trees as swiftly as he'd come. Kit stood and watched the smoke rising in the distance through the window of the room he shared with Ty. At least he assumed he was sharing the room with Ty. His bag was here, tossed into a corner, and nobody had ever bothered to tell him whether he was supposed to be in a different room. He'd gotten dressed in the bathroom that morning and emerged to find Ty pulling his T-shirt on over his head. His marks seemed unusually black, probably because his skin was so pale. He looked so delicate. Kit had to glance away from the shape of his shoulder blades, the fragility of his spine. How could he look like that and be strong enough to fight demons? Now Ty was downstairs with the rest of his family. People tended to cook when someone died, and shadow hunters were no exception. Someone was probably making a casserole, a demon casserole. Kit leaned his head against the cold glass of the window. There was a time he could have run, Kit thought. He could have run and left the shadow hunters behind, lost himself in the underground world of shadow markets, been like his father, not part of any world, existing between them. In the reflection of the window glass, Kit saw the bedroom door open and Ty come in. He was still wearing his mourning clothes, though he'd taken off the jacket and was just in a long-sleeve T-shirt. And Kit knew it was too late to run, that he cared about these people now, and specifically Ty. I'm glad you're here. Ty sat down on the bed and started unlacing his boots. I wanted to talk to you. The door was slightly open, and Kit could hear voices coming from the kitchen downstairs. Helen's, Drew's, Emma's, Julian's. Diana had gone back to her own house. Apparently she lived in a weapons store or something like that. She'd gone back to get some kind of tool she thought could fish the splinters out of Julian's bleeding hands. Ty's hands were fine, but he'd been wearing gloves. Kit had seen Julian's when he'd gone to rinse them out of the sink, and they looked like shrapnel had blown into his palms. Emma had stood nearby looking worried, but Julian had said he didn't want neurotsy, that it would just heal the skin closed over the bits of wood. His voice had sounded flat. Kit had barely recognized it. "I know how this is going to sound," Kit said, turning so his back was against the cold glass. Ty was hunched over, and Kit caught the gleam of gold at his neck. "But you're not acting the way I expected." Ty kicked his boots off. "Because I climbed up the pyre?" "No, that was kind of actually the most expected thing you did," said Kit. I did it to get this," Ty said, and put his hand to his throat. Kit recognized the gold chain and the slim disc of metal attached to it. Livy's locket, the one he'd helped her with in London. It had a circlet of the family thorns on the front, and she had told him Julian had added an etching to the back, a pair of crossed sabers, Livy's weapon. Kit vividly remembered her holding her hair aside as he fastened the clasp, and the smell of her perfume. His stomach lurched with sadness. "Livy's necklace," he said. "I mean, I guess it makes sense. I just thought you would cry." Ty didn't look angry, but the intensity in his gray eyes had deepened. He was still holding the pendant. "Everybody is supposed to be sad, but that's because they accept Livy is dead. But I don't. I don't accept it."
"What?"
"I'm going to get her back," said Ty. Kit sat down heavily on the windowsill. "How are you going to do that?" Ty let go of the necklace and took his phone out of his pocket. "These were on Julian's phone," he said. "He took them when he was in the library with Annabelle. They're photos of the pages of the Black Volume of the Dead."
"When did you get these?"
Kit knew texting didn't work in Idris.
"Does Julian know you have them?"
"I set up his phone so it would back up to mine. I guess he didn't realize. Then, when I saw these in London, I..." Ty gave Kit a worried frown. "You won't tell him, will you?"
"Of course not."
"Will you come and sit down next to me so you can see them?" Kit wanted to say no. He couldn't say it. He wanted this not to be happening, but it was. When he sat down next to Ty on the bed, the mattress sagged, and he knocked against Ty's elbow accidentally. Ty's skin felt hot against his, even through his t-shirt, as if the other boy had a fever. It had never crossed his mind that Ty was lying or wrong, and he didn't seem to be either. After 15 years with Joni Rook, Kit was pretty familiar with what bad spell books were like, and this one looked decidedly evil. Spells and cramped handwriting littered the pages, along with creepy sketches of corpses crawling out of the grave, screaming faces, and charred skeletons. Ty wasn't looking at the photographs like they were creepy, though. He was looking at them like they were the Holy Grail. "This is the most powerful spellbook for bringing back the dead that's ever existed," he said. "That's why it didn't matter if they burned Libby's body. With spells like these, she can be brought back whole, no matter what happened to her, no matter how long." He broke off with a shuddering breath. "But I don't want to wait. I want to start as soon as we get back to Los Angeles."
"Didn't Malcolm kill a lot of people to bring Annabelle back?" said Kit.
"Correlation, not causation, Watson," said Ty. "The simplest way to do necromancy is with death energy. Life for death, basically. But there are other sources of energy. I would never kill anyone." He made a face that was probably supposed to be scornful, but was actually just cute.
"I don't think Livy would want you to do necromancy," Kit said.
Ty put his phone away.
"I don't think Livy would want to be dead."
Kit felt the words like a punch to the chest, but before he could reply, there was a commotion downstairs. He and Ty ran to the top of the stairwell, tie in his stocking feet and look down into the kitchen. Zara Dearborn's Spanish friend Manuel was there, wearing the uniform of a guard officer and a smirk. Kit leaned forward more to see who he was talking to. He caught sight of Julian leaning against the kitchen table, his face expressionless. The others were ranged around the kitchen. Emma looked furious, and Christina had her hand on the other girl's arm, as if to hold her back.
"Really?" Helen said furiously. "You couldn't wait until the day after our sister's funeral to drag Emma and Jules to the guard?"
Manuel shrugged, clearly indifferent. "It has to be now," he said.
"The consul insists."
"What's going on?" Aline said.
"You're talking about my mother, Manuel. She wouldn't just demand to see them without a good reason."
"It's about the mortal sword," Manuel said. "Is that a good enough reason for all of you?"
Ty tugged at Kit's arm, pulling him away from the stairs. They moved down the upstairs hallway, the voices in the kitchen receding but still urgent.
"Do you think they'll go?" Kit said.
"Emma and Jules?
They have to. The consul's asking," said Ty. "But it's her, not the Inquisitor, so it'll be all right."
He leaned in toward Kit, whose back was against the wall. He smelled like a campfire.
"I can do this without you. Bring Livy back, I mean," he said.
"But I don't want to. Sherlock doesn't do things without Watson."
"Did you tell anyone else?"
"No." Ty had pulled the sleeves of his shirt down over his hands and was worrying at the fabric with his fingers.
"I know it has to be a secret. People wouldn't like it, but when Livy comes back, they'll be happy, and they won't care."
"Better to ask forgiveness than permission," Kit said, feeling dazed.
"Yes."
Ty wasn't looking directly at Kit. He never did. But his eyes lit up hopefully. In the dim light of the hallway, the gray in them was so pale it looked like tears.
Kit thought of Ty sleeping, how he'd slept the whole day of Livy's death and into the night, and the way Kit had watched him sleep in terror of what would happen when he awoke. Everyone had been terrified. Ty would fall apart, they'd thought. Kit remembered Julian standing over Ty as he slept, one hand stroking his brother's hair, and he'd been praying. Kit didn't even know Shadowhunters prayed, but Julian definitely had been. Ty would crumble in a world without his sister, they'd all thought. He'd fall away to ashes, just like Livy's body. And now, he was asking Kit for this, saying he didn't want to do it without him. And what if Kit said no, and Ty crumbled from the pressure of trying to do it alone? What if Kit took away his last hope and he fell apart because of it?
"You need me," Kit said slowly.
"Yes."
"Then," Kit said, knowing already that he was making a huge mistake, "I'll help you."
It was cold in the Scholomance, even during the summer. The school had been carved into a mountainside, with long windows running all along the cliff face. They provided light, as did the witch-light chandeliers in nearly every room, but no warmth. The chill of the lake below, deep and black in the moonlight, seemed to have seeped into the stone of the walls and floor and to radiate outward, which was why, even in early September, Diego Rocio Rosales was wearing a thick sweater and coat over his jeans. Dusty witchlight sconces cast his shadow, long and thin, in front of him as he hurried down the hallway toward the library. In his opinion, the Scholomance was direly in need of an update. The one time his brother Jaime had ever visited the school, he said it looked as if it had been decorated by Dracula. This was unfortunately true. Everywhere there were iron chandeliers, which made Kieran sneeze, bronze dragon-shaped sconces holding ancient witchlight stones, and cavernous stone fireplaces with huge carved angels standing forbiddingly on either side. Communal meals were taken at a long table that could have accommodated the population of Belgium, though at the moment there were less than 20 people in residence at the school. Most of the teachers and students were either at home or in Idris, which made it much easier for Diego to hide a fairy prince on the premises. He'd been nervous about the idea of concealing Kieran at the Scholomance. He wasn't a good liar at the best of times, and the effort of maintaining a relationship with Zara had worn him down already. But Christina had asked him to hide Kieran, and he would have done anything for Christina. He'd reached the end of the corridor where the door to the library was. Long ago, the word Bibliotheca had adorned the door in gold lettering. Now only the outlines of the letters remained, and the hinges squeaked like distressed mice when Diego shoved the door open. The first time he'd been shown the library, he thought it was a prank. A massive room, it was on the top floor of the Scholomance, where the roof was made of thick glass and light filtered down through it. During the time that the school had been deserted, massive trees had taken root in the dirt beneath the floor. Kieran had commented that they seemed to have the strength of fairy oaks. No one had had the time or money to remove them. They remained, surrounded by the dust of broken stone. Their roots had cracked the floor and snaked among the chairs and shelves. Branches spread out wide above, forming a canopy over the bookshelves, dusting the seats and floors with fallen leaves. Sometimes Diego wondered if Kieran liked it in here because it reminded him of a forest. He certainly spent most of his time in a window seat, somewhat grimly reading everything in the section on fairies. He had made a pile of books he considered accurate. The pile was small. He glanced over as Diego came in. His hair was blue-black, the color of the lake outside the window. He had put two books into his accurate pile and was reading a third, Mating Habits of the Unseelie. I do not know anyone in Faerie who has married a goat, he said irritably, in either the Seelie or the Unseelie court. Don't take it personally, Diego said. He pulled a chair over and sat down facing Kieran. He could see them both reflected in the window. Kieran's bony wrists stuck out below the sleeves of his borrowed uniform. Diego's clothes had all been too big for him, so Rayan Maduabachi had offered to lend Kieran some. He didn't seem bothered that Diego was hiding a fairy in his room, but nothing much ruffled the surface of Rayan's calm. Divya, on the other hand, Diego's other best friend at the school, leapt nervously into the air every time anyone mentioned they were going to the library, despite Kieran's uncanny ability to hide himself. Divya and Rayan were the only people Diego had told about Kieran, mostly because they were the only people currently at the Scholomance that he trusted. There was only one professor in residence, Professor Gladstone, who was currently in Idris for the Inquisitor's funeral. Besides, while there had been a time that Diego would have trusted a professor without a second thought, that time was past. "Have you heard anything from Idris?" said Kieran, looking down at his book. "You mean Mark," said Diego. "And I haven't heard anything from him. I am not his favorite person." Kieran glanced up. "Are you anyone's?" Somehow he managed to ask it, as if it weren't an insulting question, but something he merely wished to know. Diego, who sometimes wondered the same thing himself, didn't answer. "I thought you might have heard from Christina," Kieran closed the book, marking his place with his finger, "about whether she was all right. And Mark thought the funerals were today." "They were," Diego said. He also thought they might have heard from Christina. He knew she'd been fond of Livia Blackthorne. "But funerals for us are very busy times. There's a great deal of ceremony, and a lot of people who visit and express condolences. She might not have much time." Kieran looked pained. "That seems as if it would be annoying. In Faerie, we know to leave those who are grieving to themselves." "It's annoying, but also not," Diego said. He thought of the death of his grandfather, how the house had been full of velas, candles that burned with a beautiful light, how visitors had come and brought gifts of food, and they had eaten and drunk together and remembered his abuelo. Everywhere there had been marigolds and the cinnamon smell of atole and the sound of laughter. It seemed cold to him and lonely to grieve by yourself, but fairies were different. Kieran's eyes sharpened as if he'd seen something revealing in Diego's expression.
"Is there a plan for me?" he asked. "Where am I to be sent when my time hiding here is over?"
"I had thought you might want to return to Los Angeles," said Diego, surprised. Kieran shook his head. Locks of his hair had turned white. His hair color seemed to change with his mood. "No, I will not go back to where Mark is."
Diego was silent. He hadn't really had a plan. Christina had asked him to hide Kieran, but had never said for how long. He had wanted to do this for her, because he knew he owed her. He had thought of Zara, had remembered the hurt on Christina's face when she'd first met Zara. It had been his fault. He hadn't told her about Zara because he'd been desperately hoping something would happen that would get him out of the engagement before it was necessary. It was the Dearborns who had insisted on the marriage contract. They had threatened to expose the Rocio Rosales family secrets if Diego didn't do something to prove to them that he was truthful when he said he didn't know where his brother was and didn't know where the artifact was that Jaime had taken. There had never been a question of him loving Zara, or of her loving him. She seemed to feel it was a feather in her cap to be engaged to the son of an important family. But there was no passion in her except passion for the horrible causes her father espoused. Kieran's eyes widened.
"What's that?"
That was a bright light, like a will-o'-the-wisp over Diego's shoulder. A fire message. He caught it out of the air, and the paper unrolled in his hand. He recognized the handwriting immediately. "Christina," he said. "It's a message from Christina."
Kieran sat up so fast the book tumbled out of his lap to the floor.
"Christina? What does she say? Is she all right?"
Odd, thought Diego. He would have imagined Kieran would have asked if Mark was all right. But the thought flew from his mind almost immediately, scrawled over by the words he was reading. Feeling as if he'd been kicked in the gut, Diego handed the message over to Kieran and watched the other boy turn ashen as he read that Horace Dearborn had been made the new Inquisitor.
"This is a slap in the Blackthorn's face," said Kieran, his hand shaking. "They will be heartbroken, as will Christina. And he's a dangerous man, a deadly man." He looked up at Diego, his eyes night black and storm gray. "What can we do?"
"It is clear I know nothing of people," Diego said, thinking of Zara and Jaime, of all the lies he had told and how none of them had accomplished what he had wanted, but had only made everything worse. "No one should ask me how to solve anything." As Kieran looked at him, astonished, he dropped his face into his hands.
"I know these words must seem empty at this point," said Gia, "but I'm so sorry about Livia."
"You're right," said Julian. "They do."
It was as if grief had plunged Julian into a bath of ice, Emma thought. Everything about him was cold. His eyes, his expression, the tone of his voice. She tried to remember the boy who'd clung to her with such passion the night before, but it felt a million miles away. It was late afternoon, and the demon towers were strung across the skyline of Alicante, like a row of jagged diamonds. Emma looked around, remembering the last time she'd been in this room. She'd been 12, and she'd been so impressed at how plush it was, with thick rugs underfoot and a desk of gleaming mahogany. She, Julian, and Diana were all seated in wingback armchairs before Gia's desk. Diana looked furious. Julian just looked blank.
"These kids are tired and grief-stricken," Diana said. "I respect your judgment, Gia, but does this have to be now?"
"It does," she said, "because Horace Dearborn wants to interrogate Helen and Mark and any other downworlders or part-downworlders in Alicante.
Magnus and Alec are already packing their things to portal out tonight.
Evelyn Highsmith returned to the London Institute, so they can go home to New York. Gia pressed her fingers against her forehead. I would have thought you would have wanted Helen and Mark to leave as well.
He wants to what? Emma sat up, indignant. You can't let him.
I don't have a choice. He was elected by a majority vote, Gia frowned. Interrogating people is what the Inquisitor does. The decision is at his discretion.
Horace Dearborn has no discretion, said Diana.
Which is why I'm giving you advance notice, said Gia. I suggest that Helen and Mark, and Aline, since she won't leave Helen, be portaled to Los Angeles tonight.
There was a moment of silence. You're offering to send Helen to Los Angeles? Said Julian finally. Not Wrangell Island?
I'm suggesting Helen and Aline temporarily run the Los Angeles Institute, said Gia, and Emma actually felt her mouth fall open. As the consul, that is within my power, and I believe I can make it happen now while Dearborn is distracted.
So you're saying we should all portal back? Emma said. And Helen and Aline can come with us? That's great, that's...
She doesn't mean all of us, said Julian. His hands were both bandaged. He'd got most of the splinters out himself with the tip of a sharp knife, and there was blood on the bandages.
He didn't seem to have felt it.
Emma had felt the pain herself, watching his skin split under the blade, but he had never wavered.
She means, Diana, you and I are going to stay here in Idris.
You've always been clever, Julian, said Gia, although not as if she admired the quality all that much.
If Helen and Mark aren't here, he'll interrogate us, said Julian. Isn't that true?
No, Diana said sharply. They're children.
Yes, said Gia, and one of them broke the mortal sword. The Inquisitor, like everyone else, is desperate to know how. Cortana is a legendary sword, but still just a sword.
It should not have been able to shatter Malartok.
He can ask me, but I don't know why it was broken, Emma said. I swung at Annabelle because she was trying to kill me. It was self-defense.
People are terrified, and fear isn't logical, said Gia.
Thank the angel that the cup and mirror are unaffected, she sighed. This was the worst possible time for the mortal sword to be broken, at a time of serious instability, and on the eve of a possible war with fairies. And after the Unseelie King snatched Annabelle from the council hall, don't you understand how aware the Clave is that you brought her here?
That was just me, Julian was white around the mouth. Emma didn't have anything to do with it.
Emma felt a faint spark of relief light among her fear.
He still has my back.
Gia looked down at her hands.
If I were to send all of you back home right now, there would be a riot. If Dearborn is allowed to question you, then public attention will swing away from you. The cohort suspects your loyalty, mostly because of Helen and Mark.
Julian gave a harsh laugh.
They suspect us because of our brother and sister? More than because I brought that thing, because I brought Annabelle into the city, and promised everything would be all right? But it's Mark and Helen's blood that matters.
Blood always matters to the wrong sort of people, said Gia, and there was a rare bitterness in her voice.
She passed a hand over her face. I'm not asking you to be on his side.
God, I'm never asking that.
Just get him to understand that you're victims of Annabelle.
Those not in the cohort are very sympathetic to you right now because of Livia. He won't want to go too much against public opinion.
So this is like a pointless little dance we're doing, Emma said. We let the Inquisitor question us, mostly for show. Then we go home?
Gia smiled grimly.
Now you understand politics. You're not worried about making Aline and Helen the heads of the Los Angeles Institute, given the cohort's concerns about Helen, said Diana.
It'll just be Aline. Julian gazed unwaveringly at Gia. The consul's daughter. Helen won't be running anything.
That's right, said Gia. And no, I don't like it either. But this may be a chance to get them back permanently from Wrangell Island. That's why I'm asking for your help,
All three of you.
Am I going to be interrogated as well? There was a sharp tension in Diana's voice.
No, said Gia. But I'd like your help. As you helped me before with those files.
Files? Echoed Emma.
How are files important right now?
But Diana looked as if she understood some secret language Gia was speaking.
I'll stay, certainly, she said. As long as the understanding is clear that I'm helping you, and that my interests are in no way aligned with the Inquisitors.
I understand, said Gia.
Nor are mine, hung unspoken in the air.
But the kids, said Emma. They can't go back to Los Angeles without us.
She turned to look at Julian, waiting for him to say he wouldn't be separated from his younger siblings, that they needed him, that they should stay in Idris.
Helen can take care of them, he said, without glancing at her. She wants to. It'll be all right. She's their sister.
Then it's decided, said Gia, rising from behind her desk. You might as well get them packed. We'll open the portal for them tonight.
Julian rose as well, pushing back the hair that had fallen into his eyes with one of his bandaged hands.
What the hell is wrong with you? Emma thought. There was something going on with Julian, beyond what could be explained by grief.
She didn't just know it, she felt it, down in the deep place where the parabatai bond tugged at her heart. And later tonight, when the others were gone, she would find out what it was.
Chapter 5. Wilderness of Glass.
When Emma came into Christina's room, she found her friend already packing. Christina packed like she did everything else, with neatness and precision. She carefully rolled all her clothes so they wouldn't get wrinkled, sealed anything damp into plastic, and put her shoes into soft bags so they didn't mark up any fabric.
You realize that when I pack, I just throw everything into a suitcase and then sit on it while Julian tries to zip it up, right? Said Emma.
Christina looked up and smiled.
The thought gives me hives.
Emma leaned against the wall. She felt bone-tired and strangely lonely, as if Christina and the Blackthorns had already departed.
Please tell me you'll be at the L.A. Institute when I get back, she said.
Christina stopped packing. She glanced down at the suitcase the Penhallows had provided, open on the bed, worrying her lower lip between her teeth.
Do you know how long it will be?
A few days.
Do you think the family will want me to stay?
Christina turned wide, dark eyes on Emma.
I could just go home. My study year isn't over, but they would understand.
I feel as if I'm intruding.
Emma pushed herself off the wall, shaking her head vigorously.
No, no, you're not, Tina, you're not.
Quickly, she described her conversation with Jem and the issue of the ley line contamination.
Jem thought I was going back to Los Angeles, she said. He asked me to contact Katerina and help her find out more about the ley lines. But it'll have to be you. Helen and Aline will be so overwhelmed with the kids and with their grief and everyone.
I know you can do it, Christina. I trust you.
Christina gave her a slightly watery smile.
I trust you, too.
Emma sat down on the bed. It creaked in protest, and she kicked it, bruising her heel, but relieving her feelings somewhat.
I don't mean that Helen and Aline won't be any help. It's just that everyone's destroyed with grief. They're going to need someone who isn't destroyed to turn to. They'll need you.
She took a deep breath.
Mark will need you.
Christina's eyes widened, and Emma suddenly remembered Mark's face an hour ago in the kitchen, when she and Julian had broken the news that the family would be returning to Los Angeles tonight without the two of them. His expression had stiffened. He had shaken his head and said,
"Ill news.
I cannot."
Breaking off, he'd sat down at the table, his hands shaking slightly. Helen, already sitting at the table, had gone white, but said nothing, while Aline put her hand on her wife's shoulder. Drew had silently walked out of the room. After a moment, Mark had risen and gone after her. Tavi was protesting,
offering 100 different arguments for why Julian should go with them, and why they didn't need to stay, and the Inquisitor could come to Los Angeles instead, or they could do the interrogation over Skype, which would have made Emma laugh if she hadn't felt so awful.
"We're going home?"
Helen had said. Julian had bent down to talk to Tavi in a low voice. Emma could no longer hear them.
"Back to Los Angeles?"
"I'm really happy for you, and Gia says she thinks you can stay," Emma had said.
"She hopes," Aline said. "She hopes we can stay."
She looked calm, but her grip on Helen was tight. Emma didn't blame her. She understood not daring to hope.
"But not without you," Helen said, looking troubled. "We should stay as long as you're here."
"No." To everyone's surprise, it was Ty. "That would be dangerous for Mark, and for you. This plan makes sense." Kit had given Ty an almost indecipherable look, half concern, and half something else.
"Home,"
Helen said, her eyes glimmering with tears. She looked at Julian, but he was picking up a protesting Tavi. He carried him out of the room.
"I don't know if I'm crying because I'm sad or happy," she added,
brushing away the tears with damp fingers. Aline had kissed the top of her head.
"Both, I imagine."
Emma had been halfway up the stairs on the way to Christina's room when she had seen Mark, leaning against the wall on the landing and looking dejected.
"Drew won't let me talk to her," he said. "I am worried. It is like a fairy to grieve alone, but not, I understand, like a shadow hunter."
Emma hesitated. She was about to say that it wasn't unlike Drew to lock herself in a room alone, but Drew had looked more than a little upset when she left the kitchen.
"Keep trying," she advised. "Sometimes you have to knock for 20 minutes or so. Or you could offer to watch a horror movie with her."
Mark looked glum.
"I don't think I would enjoy a horror movie." "You never know," Emma said.
He had turned to head back up the stairs and hesitated.
"I am worried about you and Jules as well," he said more quietly. "I do not like the Inquisitor, or the idea of you being questioned by him. He reminds me of the King of Unseelie."
Emma was startled.
"He does?" "They give me the same feeling," Mark said. "I cannot explain it, but..."
A door opened on the landing overhead. It was Christina's. She stepped out, glancing down.
"Emma, I wondered if you were..."
She had stopped when she saw Mark, and she and Mark stared at each other in a way that made Emma feel as if she had disappeared completely.
"I didn't mean to interrupt,"
Christina said, but she was still looking at Mark. And he was looking back, as if their gazes were hopelessly tied together. Mark had shaken himself, as if he were casting off cobwebs or dreams.
"It is all right. I must go speak with Drusilla."
He had bounded up the stairs and out of sight, disappearing around the bend in the corridor. Christina had snapped out of it and invited Emma in, and now it was as if the moment with Mark had never happened, though Emma was itching to ask about it. "Mark will need you," she said again, and Christina twisted her hands in her lap.
"Mark," she said and paused. "I don't know what Mark is thinking. If he is angry at me..."
"Why would he be angry at you?"
"Because of Kieran," she said. "They did not end things well, and now Kieran is at the Scholomance, and far away, which was my doing."
"You didn't break him up with Kieran," Emma protested. "If anything, you helped keep them together longer. Remember, hot fairy threesome?" Christina dropped her face into her hands.
"Can I send me a note?"
she said.
"What?"
"I said,"
Christina repeated, lifting her face,
"that Kieran sent me a note."
"He did? How? When?"
"This morning, in an acorn."
Christina passed a small piece of paper to Emma.
"It isn't very illuminating.
Lady of Roses. Though the Scholomance is cold and Diego is boring, I am so grateful that you found enough value in my life to save it. You are as kind as you are beautiful. My thoughts are with you. Kieran."
Why did he send you this? Emma handed the note back to Christina, shaking her head. It's weird. He's so weird.
I think he just wanted to thank me for the escape plan, Christina protested. That's all.
Fairies don't like thanking people, said Emma. This is a romantic note. Christina blushed.
It's the way fairies talk. It doesn't mean anything.
When it comes to fairies, Emma said darkly, everything means something.
Drew ignored the pounding on the door. It wasn't hard. Since Livy died, she felt like she was underwater, and everything was happening at a distant remove, far above the surface. Words seemed to be echoes, and people were blurs that came and went like flickers of sunshine or shadow. Sometimes, she would say the words to herself. Livy, my sister Livy, is dead. But they didn't feel real either. Even watching the pyre burn had felt like an event that was happening to someone else. She glanced out the window. The demon towers gleamed like shards of beautiful glass. Drew hated them. Every time she'd ever been in Alicante, horrible things had happened. People had died. Helen had been exiled. She sat down on the windowsill, still holding a rolled-up t-shirt in her hand. Helen. For so long they had all wanted Helen back. It had been a family goal, like wanting Mark back and wanting the cold peace over and wanting Jules to be happy and for that forever worried line between his eyes to go away. But now Helen was back. She was back, and she was apparently going to take over for Jules. Helen will be taking care of you, he'd said, as if he could just walk away from that and Helen could just pick it up, as if they weren't a family, but they were a carelessly dropped penny or a gerbil. You're treating me like a gerbil, she thought, and wondered what would happen if she said that to Jules. But she couldn't. Since Livy had died, the worried line had gone between his eyebrows, replaced by a blank look that was 1,000 times worse. Getting Mark back had been one thing. Mark had been happy to be with him, even when he'd been strange and said odd fairy things. And he told Drusilla that she was beautiful, and he'd try to cook even though he couldn't. But Helen was thin and beautiful and remote. Drew remembered when Helen had gone off to Europe for her study year with a dismissive wave and an eagerness to be gone that had felt like a slap. She'd returned with Aline, sparklingly happy, but Drew had never forgotten how glad she'd been to be leaving them. She isn't going to want to watch horror movies with me and eat caramel corn, Drew thought. She probably doesn't eat anything except flower petals. She isn't going to understand a thing about me. She isn't going to want to try. Unwrapping the t-shirt she was holding, she took out the knife and the note that Jaime Rocio Rosales had given her in London. She'd read the note so many times that the paper had grown thin and worn. She hunched over it, curled up on the windowsill as Mark knocked on her door and called her name in vain. The house felt echoingly empty. The trip back and forth to the portal room at the guard had been chaotic, with Tavi complaining and Helen frantically asking Julian about the everyday running of the Institute, and the odd electricity between Christina and Mark, and Ty doing something odder with his phone. On the walk back, Diana had mercifully broken the silence between Emma and Julian by chatting about whether or not she was going to sell the weapon shop on Flintlock Street. Emma could tell Diana was making a conscious effort to avoid awkward breaks in conversation, but she appreciated it all the same. Now Diana was gone, and Emma and Julian climbed the steps to the canal house in silence. Several guards had been posted around the place, but it still felt empty.
The house had been full of people that morning. Now, it was only her and Julian.
He threw the bolt on the front door and turned to go up the stairs without a word.
Julian, she said, I need to talk to you.
He stopped where he was, hand on the banister. He didn't turn to look at her.
Isn't that sort of a cliche? He said.
We need to talk.
Yeah, that's why I changed it to I need to talk to you. But either way, it's a fact, and you know it, Emma said. Especially since we're going to be alone with each other for the next few days, and we have to face the Inquisitor together.
But this isn't about the Inquisitor. He did finally turn to look at her, and his eyes burned acid blue-green. Is it?
No, Emma said. For a moment she wondered if he was actually going to refuse to have a conversation, but he shrugged finally and led the way upstairs without speaking. In his room, she closed the door and he laughed, a tired sort of noise.
You don't have to do that. There's no one else here.
Emma could think of a time they would have been delighted to have a house to themselves, when it was a dream they'd shared. A house to themselves, forever, a life of their own, forever. But it did seem almost blasphemous to think about that, with Livy dead. She had laughed earlier with Christina, a flicker of joy in the dark. Now she wanted to shiver as Julian turned around, his face still blank, and looked at her. She moved closer to him, unable to stop herself from studying his face. He had explained to her once that what fascinated him about painting and drawing was the moment when the illustration took on life, the dab of paint or a flick of a pen that changed a drawing from a flat copy to a living, breathing interpretation. The Mona Lisa's smile, the look in the eyes of a girl with a pearl earring. That was what was gone from Julian, she thought, shivering again. The thousands of emotions that had always lived behind his expressions. The love for her, for his siblings, behind his eyes. Even his worry seemed to have gone. And that was stranger than anything else. He sat down on the edge of his bed. There was a spiral-bound drawing notebook there. He shoved it carelessly aside, almost under one of his pillows. Julian was usually fastidious about his art supplies. Emma pushed back the urge to rescue the sketchpad. She felt lost at sea. So much seemed to have changed. "What's going on with you?" she said.
"I don't know what you mean," Julian said. "I'm grieving my sister. How am I supposed to be acting?"
"Not like this," Emma said. "I'm your parabatai. I can tell when something's wrong. And grief isn't wrong. Grief is what I'm feeling. What I know you were feeling last night. But, Julian, what I feel from you now isn't that. And it scares me more than anything."
Julian was silent for a long moment. "This is going to sound strange," he said finally. "But can I touch you?"
Emma stepped forward so that she was standing between his legs, within arm's reach. "Yes," she said. He put his hands on her hips, just over the band of her jeans. He drew her close, and she put her hands gently on the sides of his face, curling her fingertips against his cheekbones. He closed his eyes, and she felt his lashes brush the sides of her fingers. "What is this?" she thought. "Julian, what is this?" It wasn't as if he'd never hidden anything from her before. He'd hidden a whole secret life from her for years. Sometimes he'd been like a book written in an indecipherable language. But now he was like a book that had been shut and locked with a dozen heavy clasps. He leaned his head against her, soft, wavy hair brushing her skin where her t-shirt rode up. He raised his head slightly, and she felt the warmth of his breath through the fabric. She shivered as he pressed a soft kiss to the spot just above her hip bone. When he looked up at her,
His eyes were fever bright.
I think I solved our problem, he said.
She swallowed down her desire, her confusion, her tangle of unsorted feelings.
What do you mean?
When Robert Lightwood died, Julian said, we lost our chance of exile. I thought maybe grief, the overwhelming pain of it, would make me stop loving you. His hands were still on Emma's hips, but she didn't feel comforted by that. His voice was terrifyingly flat. But it didn't. You know that. Last night,
we stopped, Emma said, her cheeks flushing as she remembered. The shower, the tangle of sheets, the salt and soap taste of kisses.
It's not the actions, it's the emotions, said Julian. Nothing made me stop loving you. Nothing made me even slow down. So I had to fix it. A cold knot of dread settled in Emma's stomach.
What did you do?
I went to Magnus, Julian said.
He agreed to do a spell. I don't think he wanted to, really.
You shouldn't have asked him, Emma said, thinking of the poisoned ley lines. He's sick. All the warlocks are. And doing magic makes them sicker.
There was a lot at stake here, Emma, Julian said. I don't think Magnus believed either of us had much of a choice.
He said this kind of magic, messing with people's emotions, can have dangerous repercussions, but...
Messing with your emotions?
Emma took a step back, and his hands fell to his sides.
What do you mean?
He took them away, said Julian. My emotions. My feelings for you. They're gone.
I don't understand.
Emma had always wondered why people said that when it was clear they did understand perfectly. She realized now. It was because they didn't want to understand. It was a way of saying, no, you can't mean it. Not what you just said.
Tell me it isn't true.
As long as our feelings aren't mutual, he said, it's not a problem, right? The curse can't come to pass.
Maybe.
Emma took a deep, shaking breath.
But it's not just how you feel about me. You're different. You didn't fight Gia about leaving the kids.
He looked a little surprised.
I suppose I didn't, he said.
He stood up, reaching out a hand for her, but she backed away. He dropped his arm. Magnus said this stuff wasn't precise, that was why it was a problem. Love spells, real love spells, the kind that make you fall for someone, those are black magic. They're a way of forcing emotion on people. Something like what he did to me is almost the opposite. He wasn't forcing anything on me. I asked for it, but he said emotions aren't singular. That's why there are no real cancel-out love spells. All your feelings are tied to other feelings, and they're tied to your thoughts and to who you are. Something fluttered on his wrist as he gestured. It looked like a loop of red fabric. So he said he would do his best to mostly affect only one part of my emotions, the eros part, romantic love. But he did say it would probably affect everything else I felt, too.
And has it? Emma said.
He frowned, and watching him frown tore at her heart. It was an emotion, even if it was just frustration or wonderment. I feel as if I'm behind a pane of glass, he said, and everyone else is on the other side. My anger is still there. I could feel that easily. I was angry at Gia, and when I climbed the pyre after Ty, it was atavistic, the need to protect him. There was no conscious thought to it. He glanced down at his bandaged hands. I can still feel grief over Livy, but it's bearable. It doesn't feel like it's ripping away my breath. And you, And us, Emma said grimly. I know that I loved you, he said. But I can't feel it. Loved. The past tense was like being punched. She took another step backward toward the door. She had to get out of the room. Entreat me not to leave thee, she said, reaching for the doorknob. But you've left me. You've left me, Julian. Emma, stop, he said. Last night, when I went to Magnus, the curse was happening. I felt it. I might not feel it now, but I know. I know I couldn't stand one more person dying.
I never would have agreed to stay here with you if I'd known what you'd done, Emma said. You could at least have told me. Honesty isn't an emotion, Julian.
At that, she thought, he did flinch, though it could have been a start of surprise.
Emma, no more, she said, and fled the room.
She wasn't waiting for Gwen, Diana told herself. She was definitely not sitting on her bed in the early hours of the morning, wearing a nice silk top she'd found in her closet, even though she would normally have put on her pajamas hours ago, for any reason except that she was up cleaning swords. She had 3 or 4 swords strewn across the coverlet, and she'd been polishing them in an attempt to bring back some of their original glory. They'd once been etched with twining roses, stars, flowers, and thorns. But over the years, some had darkened and discolored. She felt the twinge of guilt at having neglected her father's shop, mixed with the old familiar guilt that always accompanied thoughts of her parents.
There had been a time when all she wanted was to be Diana, and own Diana's arrow, when she had ached for Idris, and the chance to be herself in the Shadowhunter home country. Now, she felt a restlessness that went beyond that. The old hopes felt too confining, as if they were a dress she had outgrown. Perhaps you outgrew your dreams, too, as your world expanded. Tap, tap. Diana was up and off the bed the moment the window rattled. She threw up the sash and leaned out. Gwyn was hovering at eye level, his dappled horse shining in the light of the demon towers. His helmet hung by a strap from his horse's neck. There was a massive sword over his back, its hilt blackened with years of use. I could not come sooner, he said. I saw the smoke in the sky today and watched from above the clouds. Can you come with me to where it's safe?
She began to climb out the window before he was even done with his question. Sliding onto the horse's back in front of him felt familiar now, as did being circled by his enormous arms. She had always been a tall woman, and not much made her feel small and delicate, but Gwyn did. It was, if nothing else, a novel feeling.
She let her mind wander as they flew in silence past the city, over its walls and the imperishable fields. The pyres had burned away to ash, covering the grass in eerie circles of blanched gray. Her eyes stung as she looked away hurriedly toward the forest. The green trees approaching and then stretching out below them, the rills of silver streams, and the occasional rise of a stone manor house at the fringes of the woods. She thought of Emma and Julian, of the lonely shock on Emma's face when the consul had told them they'd have to stay in Idris, of the worrying blankness on Julian's. She knew the emptiness shock could force on you. She could see it in Ty as well, the deep silence and the stillness brought on by a pain so great that no wailing or tears would touch it. She remembered her own loss of Arya, how she had lain on the floor of Katerina's cottage, turning and twisting her body as if she could somehow get away from the pain of missing her sister.
We are here, Gwyn said, and they were landing on the glade she remembered.
Gwyn dismounted and was reaching up to help her down. She stroked the side of the horse's neck, and it nudged her with its soft nose.
Does your horse have a name?
Gwyn looked puzzled.
Name?
I'm going to call him Orion, said Diana,
settling herself on the ground. The grass under her was springy, and the air was scented with pine and flowers. She leaned back on her hands, and some of the tension began to leave her body.
I would like that, for my steed to be named by you.
Gwyn seated himself opposite her, large hands at his sides, his brow creased with concern. His size and bulk somehow made him seem more helpless than he would have otherwise.
I know what happened, he said. When death comes in great and unexpected ways, the Wild Hunt knows it. We hear the stories told by spilled blood.
Diana didn't know what to say. That death was unfair? That Livy didn't deserve to die that way, or anyway? That the broken hearts of the Blackthorns would never be the same? It all seemed trite. 100 times said and understood already. Instead, she said, I think I would like it if you kissed me. Gwyn didn't hesitate. He was beside her in a moment, graceful despite his bulk. He put his arms around her, and she was surrounded by a warmth and the smell of the forest and horses. She wrinkled her nose slightly and smiled, and he kissed her smiling mouth. It was a gentle kiss for all his size. The softness of his mouth contrasted with the scratch of his stubble and the hard musculature under her hands when she put them timidly on his shoulders and stroked. He leaned into the touch with a low rumble of pleasure. Diana reached up to gently cup his face, marveling at the feeling of someone else's skin. It had been a long time, and she had never imagined something quite like this. Moonlight and flowers were for other people. But apparently not. His big hands stroked her hair. She had never felt so warm or so cared for, so completely contained in someone else's affection. When they stopped kissing, it was as natural as when they had started, and Gwyn pulled her closer, tucking her into his body. He chuckled. What? She asked, craning her head up.
I wondered if kissing a fairy was different than kissing a shadow hunter, he said with a surprisingly boyish smile.
I've never kissed one, she said. It was true. Long ago, she had been too shy to kiss anyone, and too deeply sad. And later, I've kissed a few mundanes. I knew them in Bangkok. A few were trans, like me. But back then, I always felt too much as if I were keeping a secret of being Nephilim. And it felt like a shadow between me and other people. She sighed. I feel like maybe you're the only person besides Katerina who really knows everything about me.
Gwyn made a low, thoughtful noise. I like everything about you that I know.
And I like you, she wanted to say. She was shocked at how much she did like him, this odd fairy man with his capacity for great gentleness and an equal capacity for enormous violence. She had experienced him as kind, but from Mark's stories she knew that there was another side to him, the side that led the Wild Hunt on their bloody pathway between the stars. I'm going to tell them everything, she said. Emma and Julian. We're all stuck here in Idris together, and I love them like they were my little brother and sister. They should know.
Do it, if it will bring you ease to do it, said Gwyn. You owe them nothing. You have cared for them and helped them, and they know you as who you are. None of us owe every piece of our soul's history to another.
I am doing it for me. I'll be happier.
Then, by all means.
Gwyn dropped a kiss on her head. Diana sat in the warm circle of his arms and thought of Livy, and how grief and contentment could share a place in the human heart. She wondered what losses Gwyn had sustained in his life. He must have had a mother, a father, brothers and sisters, but she couldn't imagine them, and couldn't yet bring herself to ask. Later, when she was walking to Gwyn's horse for the return journey to Alicante, she noticed that the tips of her fingers were smudged with ash, and frowned. Ash must have blown on the wind from the pyres that morning. But still, It was very odd. She put it from her mind as Gwyn lifted her onto Orion's back, and they sailed up into the stars.
The rooms in the Scholomance were neither as pleasant as the rooms in most institutes, nor as unpleasant as the ones in the Shadowhunter Academy. They were clean and bare and had, in Diego's opinion, a monkish feel. Each room came with two beds, two heavy desks, and, thanks to the absence of closets, two massive wardrobes. Due to low enrollment, Diego didn't usually have a roommate, but at the moment, Kieran lay in a grouchy lump on the floor, wrapped in blankets. Folding his arms behind his head, Diego stared at the ceiling. He'd memorized the lumps and bumps in the plaster. For the first time in his life, he didn't have the concentration to read or meditate. His mind skittered like a nervous spider over thoughts of Jaime, of Christina, of the Dearborns, and the new Inquisitor. Not to mention the unhappy fairy prince who was currently thrashing around on his floor.
"How long are you planning to keep me here?"
Kieran's voice was muffled. He pulled a piece of blanket away from his face and stared at the ceiling as if he could come to understand what Diego saw in it.
"Keep you here?" Diego rolled onto his side. "You're not a prisoner. You can go whenever you like."
"I cannot," Kieran said.
"I cannot return to the Wild Hunt without bringing the wrath of the king upon the hunt. I cannot return to Faerie, for the king would find and slay me. I cannot wander the world as a wild fae, for I would be recognized. And I do not know, even now, if the king is seeking me."
"Why not return to the Institute in Los Angeles? Even if you're angry with Mark, Christina would..."
"It's because of Mark and Christina that I cannot go there."
Kieran's hair was changing color in the dim light, deep blue to pale white.
"And I'm not angry with either of them. It is only that I do not want..." He sat up. "Or perhaps I want too much."
"We can figure it out when the time comes," Diego said. "What will be best for you?"
Kieran looked at him, an uncanny, sharp look that made Diego push himself up to his elbow.
"Isn't that what you always do?" he said. "You decide you will find a solution when the time comes, but when the worst happens, you find yourself unprepared."
Diego opened his mouth to protest when there was a sharp rap on the door. Kieran was gone in a flash, so quickly that Diego could only guess where he'd disappeared to. Diego cleared his throat and called,
"Pasale!"
Divya slipped into the room, followed by Rayan. They were in their uniforms, Rayan wearing a thick sweater over his. Both he and Divya had found it difficult to get used to the cold air in the Scholomance. Divya carried a witchlight, its rays illuminating her anxious expression.
"Diego," she said, "is Kieran here?"
"I think he's under the bed," said Diego.
"That's strange," said Rayan.
He didn't look anxious, but Rayan rarely betrayed much emotion.
"He could be under the wardrobe," Diego said. "Why?"
"The cohort," said Divya. "Zara and some of the others, Samantha and Manuel and Jessica, they just portaled in with Professor Gladstone."
Kieran rolled out from under the bed. There was a dust ball in his hair.
"Do they know I'm here?"
He sat up, eyes gleaming.
"Give me a weapon, any weapon."
"Hold on there," Divya raised a hand. "We were actually thinking of a more restrained approach, like hiding you."
"I was already hiding," Kieran pointed out.
"He was under the bed," Diego said.
"Yes, but since Zara Dearborn is on her way to talk to Diego, this isn't the safest room," said Rayan. "And the cohort suspects Diego's loyalty to the cause anyway."
"They do," said Divya. "We heard them talking."
She held out a hand to Kieran as if to help him up. He eyed it with surprise, then rose to his feet unassisted.
"I would not kill her if she was unarmed," said Kieran.
"I would challenge her to a fair fight."
"Yep, and then everyone would know you were here, including the clave," said Divya. She snapped her fingers. "Come on, let's go. Quit wasting time."
Kieran looked slightly stunned. He cut his eyes sideways toward Diego, and Diego nodded.
It'll be safer for both of us.
As you command, then, Kieran said, and followed Rian and Divya out of the room, the witchlight wavering over them all. They slipped into the shadows and were gone. Diego barely had time to get out of bed and shrug into a t-shirt before the door banged open. Zara stood in the doorway with her hands on her hips, glowering. Diego wondered if he should thank her for knocking, but decided she probably didn't understand sarcasm.
I'm just about fed up with you, she said.
Diego leaned back against the wardrobe and crossed his arms over his chest. Zara's eyes skated over his biceps. She smirked.
I really had hope for our alliance, she said. But you'd better straighten up and stop sympathizing with downworlders, criminals, and ingrates.
Ingrates? Diego echoed. I'm only allowed to hang out with the grateful.
Zara blinked.
What?
I'm not sure that word means what you think it means, said Diego. English is my second language, but...
The Blackthorns are ingrates, she clarified. You need to drop them and everyone associated with them.
Her eyes bored into him.
If you mean Christina, we are only friends.
I don't care. The Blackthorns are awful. Mark's a half-breed, Ty's a weird little recluse, Drew is fat and stupid, and Julian is like Sebastian Morgenstern.
Diego burst out laughing.
He's what?
She flushed.
He raised the dead.
He didn't, actually, said Diego, though he knew it didn't matter. The cohort constantly changed the rules of the game when they were trying to make a point. They didn't care too much whether their evidence was accurate, nor were they going to be interested in the difference between raising the dead and just associating with them.
You'll be sorry when he's burning the world down, she said darkly.
I bet I will, said Diego.
Look, do you have anything else to say? Because it's the middle of the night, and I'd like to get some sleep.
Remember why you agreed to get engaged to me in the first place, she said with a sharp little grin.
Maybe you should have thought about what the consequences would be if I had to break it off.
She turned to go, and Diego saw her pause, as if she'd caught sight of something that surprised her. She shot a last glare at him and stalked off down the corridor. There was no lock on the door. All Diego could do was kick it shut before flopping back down on his bed. He stared at the ceiling again, but this time it provided no distraction.
Chapter 6 From a Proud Tower.
Emma awoke with a pounding headache to a knocking on her bedroom door. She had fallen asleep on the floor in all her clothes. Her hair was damp, sticking to her cheeks. She felt, and suspected she looked, like a shipwreck.
Come in, she called, and the door swung open. It was Julian.
She sat up. For a moment they simply stared at each other. Emma felt cold all over. He would notice her blotchy face, her rumpled clothes. Even if he didn't love her, he would feel.
You'd better get dressed and cleaned up, he said.
He wore jeans and a blue sweater, and looked as if he'd slept fine. He looked good, even, like a handsome stranger, someone she didn't know. There was nothing harsh in his voice, just a calm pragmatism. She hadn't needed to worry he'd feel pity for her, she realized, or even guilt. He didn't feel anything at all.
Dane Larkspear just came by the house with a message, he said. The Inquisitor wants to see us right away.
The moment Christina opened the door to the kitchen, Helen popped up from behind the counter, holding a ladle and smiling brightly.
Good morning.
Christina had woken early, her body scrambled by the time difference between L.A. and Idris, and sleepwalked her way to the kitchen, meaning to throw together some toast and coffee. Helen's energetic greeting made her want to lie down and nap on the table. She would never understand morning people, especially those who functioned without a caffeine injection.
I'm making oatmeal, Helen went on.
Oh, said Christina. She didn't really like oatmeal.
Aline's up in the office trying to make sense of all the papers. It looks like the Centaurians tore the place apart.
Helen grimaced.
I know.
Christina looked longingly at the coffee maker. Would it be rude to push past Helen and grab for the coffee beans and filter?
Don't bother, Helen said. The Centaurians left moldy coffee in the pot.
She gestured toward the sink where the coffee pot was soaking. Christina instantly hated the Centaurians even more than she had before.
Is there anything they don't ruin?
They left laundry, Mark said, coming in with his hair wet. He must have just showered. Christina felt the immediate and uncontrollable spark of nerves in her stomach and sat down on the counter stool. She could still see the healing weal of skin around Mark's wrist, where the binding spell had cut him. She had one that matched. His eyes glowed in the morning sunlight, blue and gold as the heart of the ocean. She turned quickly away from looking at him and began studying a kitchen tile depicting Hector's body being dragged around the walls of Troy.
So much laundry. Piles and piles of laundry. I'll do the laundry.
Helen moved to the stove and was stirring a pot industriously. I'm making oatmeal.
Oh, said Mark.
He met Christina's eyes briefly. A shared moment of oatmeal dislike passed between them. More blackthorns started piling into the kitchen. Ty, followed by Kit, and then Drew and Tavi. There was a babble of voices, and for a moment, things felt nearly normal. Nearly. Without Emma, she knew, the Institute would never be normal for her. Emma had been the first person she'd met in Los Angeles. Emma had befriended her instantly and without hesitation. Her introduction to L.A. had been going to all of Emma's favorite places, her secret beaches and canyon trails. It had been driving in the car with her, with the radio on and their hair down, hot dogs at Pink's, pie at Apple Pan at midnight. It was hard not to feel anchorless now, an unmoored boat on the tide. But she clung to what Emma had said to her. They'll need you. Mark will need you. Ty grabbed a bag of potato chips off the counter and handed it to Kit, who gave him a thumbs up. They had a way of communicating without words, almost like Emma and Julian did.
You don't need those, Helen said. I'm making oatmeal.
She pointed at the table with her spoon. She'd set it with matching bowls and even a vase with a sprig of wildflowers.
Oh, said Kit. I want pancakes, announced Tavi.
We're not staying for breakfast, said Ty. Kit and I are going to the beach. We'll see you later.
But...
Helen began, but it was no use. It already left. Ty dragging Kit behind him with a firm grip on his wrist. Kit shrugged apologetically before disappearing through the door.
I hate oatmeal,
said Drew. She sat down at the table, frowning.
I hate oatmeal, too,
said Tavi, pushing it next to his sister. He frowned, too, and for a moment the resemblance between them was almost comical.
Well, oatmeal is what there is. Helen said. But I can make toast, too.
Not toast, said Tavi. Pancakes.
Helen shut the stove off. For a moment she stood staring down at the pot of cooling oatmeal. In a small voice she said, I don't know how to make pancakes. Christina got hurriedly off her stool.
Helen, let me help you make some eggs and toast, she said.
Julian can make pancakes, said Tavi.
Helen had made room for Christina at the counter by the stove. Christina handed over bread as Helen loaded up the toaster. Christina saw that her hands were shaking.
I don't really want eggs for breakfast, said Drew.
She picked up one of the flowers out of the vase on the table and plucked off its head. Petals showered down onto the table.
Come on, both of you,
said Mark, going over to his younger brother and